That's Master Conguero, Poncho Sanchez, with Eddie Harris on tenor sax, collaborating on this wonderful version of Mongo Santa Maria's great jazz standard, Afro Blue, made famous by John Coltrane. That's from Poncho's 1994 album, Para Todos, meaning for everybody. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Friday, November the 21st, and there's growing unrest in Ferguson, and it has led to the arrest of several protesters. The police, local police, will not confirm how many, but the Chicago Tribune is reporting at least 6 people were arrested last night. 7 were arrested the previous night, also as a result of protests. And meanwhile, a union official told the Associated Press that they are not expecting charges to be filed against police officer Darren Wilson. His quote was, "It's fair to say that neither he nor his defense team expect an indictment," unquote. Well, today normally is our Free Your Mind Friday, and we will do an aspect of Free Your Mind in the second half of this program when we will entertain questions for our guest, Alton Maddox, who has been our legal guide through the complexities of this case and the related case also in the city of New York. That's the chokehold killing of Eric Garner on Staten Island. But we bring the week to an end discussing various aspects of the legal issues involved in the case in Ferguson. And we have been concentrating on decoding all these complex issues that seem to take a distant second, if at all, if it appears at all on the radar screen of most reporting, people instead focusing on the protests and, you know, the evidence, the so-called evidence in the case. But we're saying, get foundational about it. Get very, very basic about it. And so we go to the root of this crisis. This is a crisis. It's a crisis in leadership. It's a crisis in terms of what people are expected to put up with as policing services in their community. And it's a crisis that we have been confronting for many, many years, leading out of the same basic question, which is a question that has repeatedly been posed to this nation: are African Americans citizens entitled to all the rights and privileges of full citizenship? That's the basic question. But let's introduce our guest once more, Alton Maddox, who is the People's Attorney General and who has been functioning in that capacity for many, many years, almost 40 years now in the city of New York, but also beyond its geographic boundaries, and who has a particular area of expertise here in that these are the kinds of cases that he has taken on and been victorious in, but by taking an entirely different approach to the legal questions that arise out of these cases. So, Alton, I want to thank you once again for coming on with us and being with us today to wrap up, returning to some of the basic themes that we laid out, but also talking to the audience and taking their questions. I want to thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you very much again for you, Trees, for the invitation and the opportunity to speak to your audience.
Well, let's start with where things might go, what people should keep in mind, regardless of the grand jury's decision, because we've discussed that the grand jury's decision is certainly not final. It's not a final finding by any means. Could you talk about that first?
Well, I think you start at an appropriate point, something that we need to really write down in bold print to make sure we don't forget some very basic principles. One, we can do better as a people. And two, we must recognize that this is a class action and not a personal injury action, and that the action is directed at all descendants of enslaved Africans. Thirdly, we must recognize, as you so truthfully pointed out, that there is nothing final about this announcement. There is no constitutional bar to a second grand jury considering the same questions that the first grand jury failed or refused or was unable to consider. And therefore, there is precedent for a first grand jury being unable to carry out its functions for whatever reason, and a second grand jury following the first grand jury and bringing about an indictment that would force the defendant to face a jury of his peers. So that means that prior to trial, there's no motion to dismiss to be granted or whatever, but there's a full-scale trial in which people can view things. So I think those are the very basic things that really have to be considered. If, in fact, there's another grand jury investigation, the question then becomes whether it is appropriate to initiate a grand jury investigation or to bring about a preliminary hearing, and that in the event that the governor is insisting on another secret proceeding as opposed to a public hearing, then I think the question has to be resolved in a taxpayer's lawsuit in Missouri, and that it is essential that there are some frontline troops in the legal profession to carry out that particular goal.
So, apart from the state itself, let's suppose that there is no indictment, and the state itself is going to be looked to initiate a second round of grand jury investigations. Is there room for somebody like you in the capacity of a people's attorney general acting in the public interest to compel legally another look and a review of this case by another grand jury, even if the grand jury should come in with a decision to charge, but probably not on the charges that people would expect?
Well, I think the answer is simply this. In the white community, when they fail, they start all over again with their best and their brightest. I don't see any reason why we have to do anything less than starting again with our best and our brightest. Those who did not show up the first time around and who are still waiting in the wing with the people's support to make sure that justice is done in this case.
Similarly, we have this let me just ask about what now would the implications be with respect to the federal proceeding?
Well, you know, and again, I think that's a good point. What puzzles me, and I want to bring this to the attention of others, because sometimes we get confused in our classification system. It is true that President Obama is the President of the United States, but it's also true that when President Obama took the bar exam, he took it as an oath to become an oath taker. It is also true that when I took the bar exam, that's exactly what I was doing. So from the point of Mr. Obama having any greater knowledge of the law than I do, is one that I cannot accept. So I don't want people to get the whole crazy notion that because somebody has a status in the White House, that he has all of the answers to the problems that are facing us, because that's not true. And as I said before, I'm willing, able, and ready to put my credentials and achievements on the table against anyone, including Mr. Obama. Now, having said that, what I am concerned about, even before there is a possibility of a second grand jury or the intervention of the U.S. Justice Department in this case, I'm concerned immediately about the now announcement of Mr. Holder, who is the U.S. Attorney General, to somewhat warn the people of Ferguson that they should cooperate according to the law. And I have no problems with anybody cooperating with the law. But what Mr. Holder is not saying is that duties arises out of rights. And so if the state refuses to exercise rights, then it takes off the table the duty of the citizens to carry out any responsibilities on their part. And I think we have to have a very honest conversation, and not one in which Mr. Holder, on one hand, you know, is urging people to follow the law, and the law itself has abandoned the people. And then on the other hand, Michael Brown's father encouraging others to abide by the law when he fails to realize or did not acknowledge that our struggle for justice did not start in the United States. Our struggle for justice started on the shores of Africa when we were being rounded up to come to the New World to mine the gold fields. And so it's hard for anybody who is being kidnapped from one country, one continent, and brought somewhere else, for somebody on the slave ship to remind everybody they need to remain quiet. So it's hard for me ever to see the logic of some person who claims to be a victim to turn around and decide to give everybody else instruction on how we should behave, when in fact we were all on the slave ship coming over here, and whatever anybody else decided to do, including jump off the ship and into the Atlantic Ocean and swim with the whales, seems to be, or the sharks, or whoever is out there, that seems to be a decision that they should make. And I think we should be very cautious of that, because we all members of a class, and we all subject to potential risk. And you know how I behave to that risk may be totally different than the way you behave to the same risk.
What connection, therefore, would this case have to the still unresolved grand jury proceeding in Staten Island, New York, concerning the death of Eric Garner at the hands of members of the New York Police Department?
Well, you know, I think that that they are certainly related in many different ways. One, because we have to examine the fact that we are dealing with two governors in two different states, but who all operate under the Democratic rubric. Both Jay Nixon in Missouri and Andrew Cuomo in New York are both Democrats. The question that has to be initially asked, is this really the policy of the Democratic Party? Because I don't take it as a coincidence that, you know, these things are happening. And in both situations, both governors are refusing to take the steps necessary to undermine a police state. And so I would be very concerned as a voter as to whether I'm actually in the right party and whether I am, in fact, financing or endorsing my own oppression.
We talked about the abysmal role of black leadership here, and specifically we talked about Al Sharpton and his role. We talked also about the lawyers that he brought in to counsel both families, the families in New York City, Eric Garner's family, as well as the family of Michael Brown. Whatever the decision, again, I'm moving beyond the decision because we've discussed that people shouldn't fixate on the decision itself, fixate instead on the aberrations of law and the misapplication and the abuse of law in making the cases, both cases, go down this predictable path to nowhere, no justice. But what, therefore, should be the mindset now, especially in Ferguson and the Fergusons of America?
Well, you know, one of the things that I do is that I do read the newspapers, and I know that Reverend Sharpton has a penchant for having his name in the papers. And the only thing that I have seen his name associated with recently has been his tax debt with the IRS. And I don't think that anybody could unconnect that to his silence in the newspapers otherwise, because I haven't seen any statements that he had made legitimately on both Ferguson and certainly not on Staten Island. And so my concern is what impact is this IRS announcement of his tax liability, and also the belated attack on Bill Cosby, who, by the way, is a very close friend of Reverend Sharpton. And nonetheless, I have not heard him say anything about that as well. I'm beginning to wonder, whether there's a gag rule that now have been imposed on Reverend Sharpton to, in fact, hear nothing, see nothing, and say nothing over the next few months.
If you were involved in this case, if you were involved as of counsel in both these cases, what would your recommendation be?
Well, if I was involved in both of these cases, the first thing that I would do, and the first thing I have always done, is to conduct my own investigation. And usually my own investigation has made it impossible for the state to credibly go forward with its own investigation. So that has always been my policy. That's what I did out in Howell Beach. That's what I did in Tawana Brawley. And in both cases, the local prosecutors had to give up their own responsibilities in those cases. I don't think the result would be any different if I got involved in this case, because politically, in order to get to the prosecutor's office, a lot of deals have to be cut, and sometimes those deals don't want to be examined in the future. So my first inquiry would be to actually go back and start that investigation and then move from there. And as I said before, I have always found that to have great success, because there's usually something in the case that these prosecutors want to hide, and they have to then decide whether their whole future in politics must hinge on them taking the risk of remaining as a prosecutor in a high-profile, racially motivated case.
Speaking of the word prosecutor, I must ask, insofar, I mean, just from observing the conduct of both prosecutors here and raising questions about their choice of how they proceed with the case before the grand jury, that is to say, the use of the grand jury, Is there, in order to set precedents, because this is one of the things that just does not seem to appear on the books, any challenge to how the prosecutor has handled the prosecution of these cases, beginning at the grand jury process. Is there some kind of action that can be taken to question, even after the fact, to challenge and to question the role, whether this is tantamount to prosecutorial misconduct?
Well, you know, unless you live in a county like Bronx County here in New York City, which has a substantial black population, and maybe in some other counties in the country, I think it should be routine to challenge the array of the grand jury, and that is to how they were selected and whether those selection processes are actually fair or not. And so, you know, with me, as I indicated before, you know, I'm a stickler on filing all kinds of motions. And, you know, and usually if you go behind me, the clerks in the courthouse would tell you that there's probably been nobody else has clogged up the courthouse as much as I have, just in terms of making sure every potential right has been protected. Now, I have not heard any of that going on here at all. And so that's the reason why I said that I think that when young people and others really look at what the grand jury does, they must also recognize, or should recognize, that we did not put our best foot forward, and that many of the social parasites, you know, should be replaced with social architects. And that's not my reading of the case. That's the reading of Charles Hamilton Houston. And so in this regard, clearly, there are a number of things that need to have been done, and they were not done. And I can't really expect us to expect a fair result when we have not employed fair procedures.
If we take an objective look at things, and we say to ourselves, well, we've gone far enough down the road on these kinds of cases before. I mean, you actually lose count of how many times we have come to this point. And it is the same result, essentially, with very, very few, if any, exceptions. But it is usually the same result. So this is why, in a sense, it is almost anticlimactic to be so focused on what the grand jury will do. I already said in August what the grand jury more than likely will do. You already said what the grand jury will more than likely do. When do we get to the point, or what has to happen for people's thinking to be just basically turned around on these things? And even in media, the way these cases are reported, it suggests that journalists do not have even a rudimentary understanding of the functions of the court. This was something that I, in my own journalism training program, I compel people to understand all this stuff. The court systems, how they work, you're supposed to know this if you're covering a court case.
Right.
But for example, what you pointed out, when the governor declared a state of emergency, and everybody just reported it as, well, it's a state of emergency, and he was doing this out of, you know, being proactive about things, and what a good, responsible governor he is. But you pointed out, and I asked a question, is there something wrong here? Why do we accept these things without questioning them anymore?
Well, you know, one thing that I think people have to go back and look at, you can look at my own record now because this is on the table. I mean, you know, when I talk now, I talk from a complete record of what I did. So, you know, it's not about speculation. This is just what I did. And I think the record indicates that the results that are normally visited on blacks were never visited on any case that I was involved in. That's what the record shows. I mean, so, you know, when I look at all of these cases and see all of these funny results, you know, that's an experience that I did not go through in any case that I handled. And so, you know, the question then becomes, well, maybe we are missing something, and I suggest that you are missing something here. And that's the reason why, you know, I can look at these cases and say that certain things would have happened. Because they have always happened. I've never been involved in a situation where some grand jury, including Darrell Wilson or 11 cops in Michael Stewart or whatever, did not eventually get indicted and had to stand trial and face a jury for what they did. I mean, so, you know, to me, it has required extra work, and I have certainly taken greater risk to my own security and to my own legal career and all of that. But I have never accepted what is otherwise routinely accepted by blacks in this country.
Well, we'll take a short break here and come back to questions. Questions. You are to ask questions because we've had a lot of classroom tutelage going on for this week, and hopefully you will have questions pertaining to the issues that we've discussed with our esteemed guest, Attorney at War, Alton Maddox, right after this break. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead. Our guest is the People's Attorney General, also known as Attorney at War, Alton Maddox. And we've been discussing the situation from a legal perspective in Ferguson, Missouri, having great implication to the next case, which we expect to hear from a grand jury on. And that is also a contentious grand jury, and that is the case of the killing of Eric Garner in Staten Island, New York, by members of the New York Police Department. Your questions and comments at 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. We want to encourage questions, because this has been the point of having these discussions all week, to arrive at an entirely different understanding of how the law can be manipulated to achieve predictable results. And we have here the interest of the system to maintain the and protect, if I may even go so far as to say, to protect the interests not of the victim of this case, but the person who committed this killing. We have to see how the grand jury, from very early on, the process was operating in his favor. We see how routinely the system departed from the norm, departed from the law. We have to ask questions about that. How in New York City, and we will get to that one because that's coming up soon as well, how we have strange things happening, the impaneling of a special grand jury, which is not normally done, certainly not the way that it was done here in terms of impaneling the Staten Island grand jury. From New York, Willie, you're on the air.
Yes, good afternoon, Eutrice.
Good afternoon. Your question for Alton Maddox.
Well, actually, I didn't have a question, but I wanted to let you know that there was another one here in New York at the Pink Houses in Brooklyn.
Yes.
Two rookie police doing patrol in the building, and the young man and his girlfriend come in the building, and they open fire. Now, he's
dead. Yes.
But Councilman Barron's on the case right now. So I just wanted to inform
you
on this.
Yes, thank you. That was a case that happened just last night. Police officers, rookie officers, entered the stairwell of a housing complex called the Pink Houses in Brooklyn. A man and his girlfriend decided to exit the building by using the stairwell. The police come upon them and, without warning or anything, start firing, and the man was shot and killed. So that is an unfolding situation there. Thank you for your call. Alton, what do you think about that case, by the way?
Well, you know,
it's
one of the things I like to point out, Utrice, is that with the financial support of some who gave me the money, I took out an ad indicating that there was no way in the world that bringing William Bratton, into New York City was going to do anything other than to inflame the judicial process. And so, you know, I did all I could to try to tell our people that we should refrain from, you know, any appointment of him. And I also had tried to get out. And, you know, one of the problems I have in New York now is that I'm the only person in this city who cannot go on radio or television at all. I've been totally banned. And so far, nobody in the black community has gotten a clue as to why I have been banned. But the point of it is that Bratton has his own particular style of policing, which, you know, is the kind of policing that furthered the career of Police Chief Rizzo in Philadelphia, and Police Chief Parker in Los Angeles. And so, you know, and he brings that whole thing to bear. And it's hard for our people to understand that you don't deal with personality, you deal with the policies that particular person intends to enforce. And the policies here of William Bratton was very clear, and why nobody but me, I mean, including all of the black elected officials in the city, including one that has been named as being involved in this case now, or any of the leading blacks in New York, including the Reverend Al Sharpton, had zero to say about William Bratton. And he has turned into one of the most brutal and vicious police chiefs that you can find, and we are now suffering another death under his watch. I mean, you know, already we were talking about Eric Garner, and there have been other cases before that. We've had pregnant women who have been placed in chokeholds, who've been beaten, and all of that. And this beat goes on. And the question that you ask yourself, I mean, at least if you can't do anything else, you can at least say, well, why are we having censorship in New York? This is not supposed to be a plantation. Why can't we have open airwaves? I mean, why do Utrecht lead have to flee to Florida in order to communicate back to the black community here? I mean, who are we talking about we're dealing with here? Some incompoops who can't clearly understand what is going on. I'm very frustrated, you know, to even have to do this program with you in Florida when you should be here in New York. And people ain't got the news yet as why you should not have had to leave in the first place. You know, and nobody understands censorship. I've written on it. I've tried to talk about it. It has gotten into nobody's head. You know, I'm sitting here with an organization, the United African Movement. Ain't nothing happening there. I'm still looking for one person with a ticking brain cell. I'm over here with the Freedom Party. I'm looking for somebody with a ticking brain cell there. I mean, you ask yourself, is it the water that is being used in New York that is glue that is sticking our brain, or what is the problem?
From Chicago, Henry, you're on the air with Alton Maddox.
Hey, how you doing?
Fine, thank you, Henry.
Hi, how you doing, Mr. Maddox?
Brother Henry, how you doing?
All right. Got a question. Has anybody, if there one exists, has anybody tried to legally convict the internal affairs of the Ferguson or maybe Missouri, if Missouri has an internal affairs department, or even, you know, getting this case, you know, botched the way it is? And also, too, we all know that Wilson's not going to be charged by a grand jury, but is there still a way to kind of set some sort of legal precedence, even without a conviction, so something like this won't happen again? And I'll hang up and listen to your comments.
Well, I think it's a great question, and I will tell you something that happened factually, and that is before Johnny Cochran made his transition. You know, I had an opportunity to sit down on several occasions with Johnny, tried to give him some education on what was happening here in New York and some of the things that should be done. And I remember in the Abner Louima case, the conversation I had with Johnny is that there should be a RICO count in the complaint, in the civil rights complaint. And that is a claim that the New York Police Department was engaged in racketeering, and it should be subject to receivership.
The RICO statutes means Racketeer Influence and Corrupt Organizations Act. It's the federal criminal statutes.
Right. And, you know, and so I think to answer his question, you know, what RICO does and what it would require if a civil action was brought in that regard would be for the entire police department to be put under the microscope rather than from some branch of the New York Police Department to be under that same microscope. And here in New York, what people have maybe missed is the fact that the bar associations here will not allow lawyers in New York to bring this type of relief. So, you know, I was involved in a case where I said I'm going into federal court and sue. And the next thing I know, the Bar Association and the courts had encouraged my client to leave me alone. So, you know, there's a real problem that we have because these ambulance chasers are forbidden from taking any kind of class action against a police department, and they are forbidden from using statutes like RICO to redress grievances. And, you know, I will take you back to 1974 when I first started practicing law. I started as a poverty lawyer here in New York, and what I found very early was that as a poverty lawyer, we could not bring on any class action lawsuits. So every lawsuit has to be a, quote, personal injury lawsuit in order for us to seek any kind of relief. And this was forbidden by Congress. And so now you have the bar associations doing to private attorneys the same thing that Congress did to poverty lawyers, and that is say that the relief has to be abbreviated and carefully tailored to the individual needs of a grievant instead of the needs of a class of people. And so that's what we're dealing with. You know, one way or another, and people need to rise up to this as well. This is why things keep repeating themselves. I mean, we had Amadou Diallo here in New York, got shot 41 times. His family or the estate was given hush money. The next time we look around, Sean Bell was shot at 50 times, which meant that the hush money that was given in Amadou Diallo had no effect at all on the cops in terms of what they did to Sean Bell, because now they were not only shooting 41 bullets, they were shooting 50 bullets. And so, you know, and you still have not had any kind of class action lawsuit or any kind of RICO action to address these problems.
Well, then I want to give you the opportunity here to stretch out a bit as a, you know, as a professor would, and tell us what you see as the state of affairs now, and what you strongly recommend that we, how do we reorganize our thinking? I mean, you've expressed enough frustration about it, but what would you counsel people to do?
Well, you know, I think one thing we have to recognize is that lawyers were never educated to address our problems. And so it starts with the type of legal representation that you're receiving. When law school was first established, we were in chains. We were still in chains. So no law school was established to avenge the rights of blacks because we had no rights. The problem that you have is these young lawyers who come out here who have no training in how to deal with our problems as a people, and they themselves, out of necessity, are engaging in malpractice. I mean, whether it's legal malpractice or political malpractice or whatever the case is, that's what they're engaging in themselves. And, you know, I remember I was sort of hardened about a year ago. A young lawyer who was very promising in our community called me up and said, you know, Brother Max, is there any way that you can counsel us on the law and how we should adequately and properly represent our people? And I said, you know, I would be happy to. And he said, because we don't know what the hell we're doing. Now, unfortunately, I just haven't heard back from him since then, but I think he was absolutely being candid, and that is part of the problem. There is no legal representation in our community, and there can't be any legal representation in our community because we have not been educated to represent our community.
So in light of this, what do people do? I'm just trying to find a sense of these cases, among other things, are serving as reminders. The bells are ringing loudly. Do something, not just to do something, but do something different. So well, what, you know, what is the different thing that we ought to be doing?
Right. Well, you know, one thing that happened, Utrecht, and this is for real, you probably know this, in the Central Park 7 case in which I was involved, it reached a point where the city said they were going to sell the case. Now, unfortunately, we don't really know what the terms of that settlement are. So, you know, as we talk here today about grand jury proceedings, I mean, we just had a settlement in a case that was secret. And we don't know anything about what happened there either. And none of the young men are talking. And certainly their lawyers are not talking. And so they have taken this $41 million of hush money and gone off somewhere where I don't know. But in the meantime, what is missing here is that I had told people, because I don't want to just go back into court unless I'm going to have an impact. So I had told people that on the date that this case was going to be settled, Central Park 7, I was going to actually make an appearance, and I would have filed a motion to intervene and to argue that this settlement could not take place unless other items were added to it. Now, that became all public. Here, people in New York know that's exactly what happened. And so, you know, and some people say, well, you can't practice law. I said, well, I haven't been told that. And I haven't heard of any due process hearing that has given me notice that I can't practice law. So, therefore, I'm still licensed. Now, I knew this, and William Bratton knew this, and the mayor of New York City, William de Blasio, knew this. But black folks didn't know it, and that's the problem that you have. Here I am, you know, trying to convince my own people that I can practice law, and they don't want to believe it. And then you have white folks saying, wait a minute, we better switch, do a bait and switch. We better change the date. I know we were supposed to be going back to court in October of 2014, but now we better find out what date Max can't be available. And they found out it was September 6th, which was the date Ramsey Order had to be out in Staten Island. And we better put that date on the calendar. Now, I didn't get a notice of that, but that's what they did. And so, you know, the point is, if I had gone into court, my terms of settlement would have been, had to have been granted. And among those things I wanted was a Mega Evers College Law School so that, you know, we can have an opportunity to shape our representation in New York City where we believe it should be shaped. I was going to get a public interest law firm somewhat similar to what you're talking about in Missouri in terms of the American Civil Union or other organizations to come in and actually provide backup support in these kinds of highly controversial cases. So I had a whole list of terms to be granted. But what happened was, while I was at, out in Staten Island on September 6th, not expecting that the case in the Central Park 7 were going to be advanced, you know, when I got out of Staten Island and turned on the radio, I was told by the radio, by the media, that the Central Park 7 case had been settled. So, you know, and what we had to understand, and this is the point, white people always changing the goalposts, you know, changing the boundaries, you know, in order to accommodate themselves, and we're not doing anything in response. See, that's my whole problem. And we have these people out here who are totally unqualified to be representing us on any level, you know, whether it's the black elected officials or whether it's leading blacks or whether it's some Negro activist in our community.
Well, it's quite an indictment, but I have to say it is also true that we have a crisis of leadership at almost every single level. There is no reason that in these two cases that we've been discussing, we haven't had a community of interests on the part of lawyers who would have come together even as a study group to say, well, we are going to concentrate on studying this case so that the minute something goes wrong, we can send out an alarm. We can say, well, we have filed papers to bring to the attention of the system that we are watching, that we are on top of this case. It is it is amazing to me that the conduct of the leadership here in Missouri, I'm talking about Al Sharpton in particular, And he will have to, he will not be able to shirk any responsibility here. He is responsible in large measure for how these cases ended up being treated, both in Ferguson and in Staten Island. So he just can't escape, he can't escape responsibility for it. Whichever way the grand jury votes, it's almost incidental to the larger question of the complicity of leadership and the incapacity. And I think this was voluntary. I think this was an active cooperation with the system to say, well, we are going to lay low, we're going to behave ourselves, and we will keep a lid on things. We will also direct the communities righteous outrage, we will encourage them to just keep a lid on things so that the Democratic Party wouldn't have a problem, the president wouldn't have a problem, the U.S. Attorney General wouldn't have a problem, and local Democrats seeking re-election wouldn't have a problem.
You know, Utrecht, one of the things I'll go back and say it because it's a matter of record. I said this in June of 1987. I said that Al Sharpton would bring down all of us unless we wrote a code of ethics and applied it equitably to everybody. And until we do that, until we recognize that a code of ethics is required, until we recognize that it is ethics and not religion that stick people together, that we are going to continue to suffer these indignities that are absolutely on the horizon and are absolutely suffocating us as a people.
And I must mention, even in his own case, where we had the charge, a sexual assault charge, levied by none other than an executive of his own organization against one of the lawyers he had appointed in many of the cases that he dealt, the high-profile cases that he dealt with, including the Abner Louima case, no movement on that.
No, one of his partners in crime. One of his partners in crime. And I'm going to say this today because, you know, when I step out there, people say, well, why is he stepping out? Well, I'm going to give you a few days to step out yourself. If you got any black leaders in New York City, you should call them right now and tell them to speak up on the gang rape of this black woman led by Sanford Rubinstein. All right? And so, you know, when I step out there, don't start hollering about, you know, why is he out there and he's doing all this. I'm out there because the rest of you are afraid to open your mouth.
Well, we have to bring it to an end there. We've come to the end of the program today. I want to thank you, Alton, for this week. It's been extremely informative and illuminating. And it has given, once again, it has sounded the warning bell to the community that there's a lot of work to do, and primary among the tasks is to examine for internal contradictions, and we do have them. We have to take a look at our leadership and look at the results that we're getting, or the lack thereof. So I want to thank you so much for being with us this week.
And I want to thank you very much for the invitation, Utrice, because the bottom line is that we are the people on a straitjacket and on emergency care. And, you know, there's no innocent bystanders now. I don't care who you are. You know, all hands must be on deck.
Thank you. Well, that brings us to the end of our program today. So far, still no announcement of what is going on in Ferguson. I expect over the weekend we'll see. But as I said, I want to reemphasize, do not, whatever the grand jury's decision is, don't think of it as the be-all and end-all. It is just a grand jury's decision. It is not by any means final, but it is also meant to signify that the time has come, there's no other way to put it, the time has come for people to make up their minds as to which way they ought to go. In so many ways, the hints are being given that there is a total change in attitude and in conviction of this system as regards people of color in this country. To pretend that nothing is happening means that you just are living in a whole different world. These are signs that the system has decided that it must prevail at all costs, including your so-called constitutional rights. And it also reminds us that whatever rights you think you have, they're not at all absolute. Everything, including your own right to life, is negotiable. It's been, of course, a pleasure and a privilege to be in your company. Stay right here. Coming up next is Wake Up Call with Richard Martin. Reach me at leadstories@gmail.com or on Facebook, Lead Stories with Utrice Lead. Let me know how these programs have been resonating with you. Bye-bye.